Slezak for asking me to lead. My sobriety date is February 6, 2023. My sponsor is Leo B. And my home group is the Goes to Any Length group in Orchid. I'm an alcoholic through and through, but drugs were definitely a part of my story. So I'll be discussing some of that. No disrespect intended there. One thing that my sponsor kind of, one of his little sayings, you know, he's got a lot of them. But one of them is, there's always a beginning, a middle, and an end. So, I was always taught, whenever we share our experience, whenever I've been to speaker meetings, it's always been about, sharing your experience, strength, and hope, kind of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I guess I'll just kind of stick to that. So I grew up in San Luis Obispo, so not too far from here, obviously. Don't really have a good excuse for being an alcoholic. My family was like really loving and supportive. They were always in my corner. Materially, I didn't really want for anything within reason, but I was pretty unreasonable. But anyways, my dad was a juvenile attorney. So, he represented youngsters who got in trouble. And so growing up, he was pretty familiar with what teenagers get up to, on the weekends and during the week, after hours. So he was really well acquainted with just kind of the mischief that teenagers get into. And I'm still to some extent today, am preoccupied with being well-liked and just other people's perception of me. And especially in high school, I really wanted other people to, think I was cool, one of the cool kids, So the cool kids at my high school were the kids that partied all the time, and so I really wanted to be accepted by them, and I really wanted to be a part of what they were doing. And, a lot of people share about, they, looking back, they were an alcoholic before they ever touched a drink. I don't really remember as a child, feeling different from other people. I felt pretty normal for the most part. But I will say that when I did drink for the first time, I got pretty drunk, and I remember thinking, oh, this is awesome. This is amazing. I'm going to do this, at every chance that I can get. Why don't people just do this every day? Why don't people just do this all the time? My parents were strict. Like I said, my dad was a juvenile attorney. They did whatever they could to ensure that I didn't get into as much mischief as I otherwise would have. So one of their rules was, you're in high school now, no sleepovers. Okay. Slumber parties, those are for kids. Okay. So we know that when you're a teenager and you start going to slumber parties, it's just bad news. And so I would sneak out, as often as I could within reason, my parents, I thought, were pretty quick on the uptake. So it wasn't easy for me to get out and drink, as much as I really wanted to. But I did, and every time that I went out, I did drink alcoholically. I wasn't drinking every single day. Or waking up and drinking, but every opportunity that I could, I drank, and I drank pretty hard when I did drink. So that was, I got into a little bit of trouble in high school. Definitely didn't measure up. My sister went to UCLA, really high achiever, smart girl, and I just didn't quite measure up academically with my sister, so she, like I said, went to UCLA, and I went to Santa Monica College, which is a community college down there in LA. And my parents, they put me up there. They said, as long as you are making progress in school and, working towards a degree, I didn't get into UCLA, but I got into this program. It was if you maintain a certain GPA at Santa Monica College, then, and you take a certain set of classes and you get a B average in these classes, then it basically guaranteed you admission into UCLA. So I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Do that. And that's a little bit easier, right? My parents were going to pay for me to live in Westwood, I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Anyways, things didn't go very well, you know. It was my first taste of real freedom, and, you know, I just, you know, ran with it. You know, and it, like I said, it did not go well at all. My parents got their first, they didn't send them a report card, but somewhere or other, they found out that I was flunking all my classes, you know, and they're like, this is not what we are paying for you to do, you know. Gotta bring it back home, you know. Gotta abort this mission. And so, anyways, that's you know, they brought me back home. I mean, I stayed beyond the time that they told me to come back home. You know, I said, no, I'm gonna make it on my own. You know, I'm gonna get a job. You know, I'm gonna make things happen for myself. I don't need them anyways. And I just lacked the life skills to do that. You know, and so, anyways. A month or two after they kind of pulled the plug on the whole experiment, I found my way back home too. So my tail in between my legs. So they said, okay, you can live with us. But again, you know, the same conditions apply. In order to live with us, you have to either be in school, okay, and like working towards a degree, or you have to be employed, you know, not even really gainfully employed, just have a job, you know, pretty easy conditions, you know. You would think, right? But, you know, I couldn't comply with even that. You know, I enrolled in the local city college, Cuesta, and when I enrolled there, just flunked out again, didn't get a job. My parents said, okay, you've got to leave. You can't live here anymore. And I said, you know, fine. This town can't hold me anyways, you know? I'm more of an L.A. guy anyways, okay? And so I had, I think, like a couple hundred dollars left. I was like $800 in debt. I had like a credit card with like a $1,000 limit. And I was like $800 in debt. I hadn't made any payments on it, you know. It was just free money to me, you know. And so that was enough money to put me up in a hotel for like two nights, okay. So sorry if I'm staying too much into how it was. But anyways, stayed at this hotel for a couple nights. Decided, you know, in order to really make this move back to LA happen, I'm gonna need some more cash, okay, some more liquid here. So my bright idea was I had a checking account, you know, and I had checks, right? So my plan was, okay, I'm gonna go to the Mac store in downtown San Luis Obispo. I'm gonna find the most expensive laptop that they have, right? And I'm gonna buy it with a bad check, and then I'll sell it for cash, and then we'll be ready to go down to LA, right? So that was the plan, and that's just what I did, okay? But, you know, I'm not like a criminal mastermind here, okay? So I took the expensive laptop and I brought it back to the same store that I purchased, you know, a day later. And so by then they kind of figured out the scam, right? They determined that, yeah, this check was no good. And so when I left the Mac with them for them to assess and see how much they would give me for it, they said, oh yeah, we'll take a look at it. Just come back in like an hour or two and we'll have taken a look at it. You know, we can let you know how much you want, how much we can give you for it. So I said, oh, great. You know, it's working out perfectly. So I come back, the guy says, oh yeah, we're just taking another moment or two to take a look at it. Just hold tight. Okay. And you know, of course, while I'm waiting, the slow PD roll up and I, you know, got arrested. And so for me, like, person of like my upbringing, and I'm not saying that like, oh, person of my upbringing, but I'm just saying like, just given kind of like what was expected of me and my peers and kind of their life trajectory, you know, the idea of like being arrested for what eventually was like misdemeanor grand theft, that should have been like a major wake-up call for me, you know, just spending 2 weeks in jail, that should have been like, okay, this is, something's not going right, I need to fix something in my own behavior. But it wasn't, you know, I still in that time, you know, just everybody else was the problem. And, you know, if everyone would just get off my back and let me do what I wanted to do, everything would be fine. And so I got out of jail, went back to my parents' house. Well, I love them to death, but they still hadn't really learned to totally pull the plug. Eventually they would. They gave me the same conditions, kicked me out again. And things just gradually got worse. You know, they kicked me out. I somehow pieced together a job as a lifeguard at the city pool that I worked at in high school and got fired from that job for being drunk and high on the job. You know, this is a job where you're responsible for the safety of other people, right? And I was loaded. I don't even remember working the shift. Showed up the next day and the guy, you know, told me I was done. You know, I don't want to stay in how it was for too long, but things just progressed, you know. Started using heavier and heavier substances, you know, meth, heroin, crack. For someone like me, again, this is just like someone with my upbringing. I don't want to say someone like me because that is who I am, as an alcoholic, right? That's where things will go if I don't have a connection with a higher power that, you know, and if I don't follow these simple rules that this program outlines, that is why. And that's what happened, you know? And things just got worse and worse to a point where it was Halloween, it was the day after Halloween. And I remember I was living in an apartment with my roommates. And at this point I was unemployed, unemployable, and had been for a couple of months now. So by this time, like, I wasn't strung out to the point where I was, like, physically withdrawing because, like I said, I didn't have a job. I didn't have the income to support, like, a habit that would, you know, necessitate me or would allow me to use that much where I would be withdrawing and such. So I was just, like, using people's leftovers, you know, in their needles and stuff, you know, whatever I could suck out of the leftover cotton balls. I don't even remember, you know, how it all worked. I try to not forget about where I came from, but the details of all that I don't exactly remember. But I was just like using people's leftovers, you know. And I remember waking up and one morning, I don't know, I guess it's just like a moment of clarity. I don't really have anything else to attribute it to because I was living the same life that I had been. But for some reason this morning I woke up and I could hear the voices of my roommates in the living room. And I was in my bedroom. And I heard them, they were all high. And I don't know, when people are high on opioids, I always got the feeling, I know I liked the sound of my own voice when I was high on opioids. And I could hear that they were enjoying the sound of their own voice. And it like repulsed me. I was like, these people are sick, you know? I can't believe, but I was one of them, you know? And I was doing the same exact thing that they were. And it sounds corny, sounds maybe like a cliche, but I looked in the mirror and I saw what I'd become. I don't remember exactly how underweight I was, but I mean, I was like, I want to say like 100 and this is kind of a big range, but 120 to 140 pounds. I might have been like at that lower range. I don't remember exactly, but I was really underweight when I checked into rehab. And, you know, something in me just told me this has to stop. And so I just packed a change of clothes into my duffel bag. I was living like a couple blocks away from my parents at the time. And I just walked through the living room, down the stairs, past my roommates, to my parents' house. And I knocked on the door. And I had knocked on my parents' door for favors, for help, you know, I don't know how many times, but it was a lot. And I was always, you know, there with my hand out, you know, can you please give me some money? You know, can I do a load of laundry? Can I have this or that? Just trying to get something from them to ease things for me. And they'd gone to therapy at this point and kind of learned that the best thing that they could do for me was just let me fall on my face, you know? But they could tell this time around when I opened the door, I don't know what it was, but something in me must have changed where they could see that, like, no, this is different. He's actually asking for help this time around. I mean, I broke down. And it wasn't just like crocodile tears. Like, something in me just, like, broke. And it all just kind of, like, flooded out of me, and I just started sobbing and told them, you know, I want to change, you know, I got to do something different. So they said, okay, you can stay here for the night, and you have to leave tomorrow at noon, okay? So whether that means you get into a treatment program or not is up to you, but you have until noon. We'll help you if you get into a treatment program, we'll take you there, but you've got to be out of the house by noon. So I got on the phones and called Santa Barbara, the hospital down there, Cottage, and got into, luckily they had a bed open for me, and I got into the 28-day program that they have down there, CRC. And that's kind of like where my first real stretch of sobriety began, and I was 20 years old at the time. So I'm really grateful that, you know, things didn't get worse than they did. I remember the first couple of, like, I want to make it clear that my experience at rehab was not AA, right? It was this, like, hospital-funded, like, program But one thing I'll say about like my experience there was that in the first night or two there, I remember like hitting my knees and praying. And I don't know what like overcame me, but I did do that. And I won't say it was like an overwhelming light that, you know, kind of like what Bill W. talked about. I don't think it was like on that level, but I do remember something happening and just hitting my knees and praying and feeling something, feeling like it was going to be okay if I did rely on God. And, you know, other than that, like being sober in that rehab facility, it's kind of, for me, it was kind of easy. I'm not trying to brag, but it was like, you know, they shuttle you around to meetings, right? It was pretty comfortable. There was like a well-stocked fridge, you know, they brought in panels. Like it felt easy to stay sober in that environment. You know, there's ping pong, you know, they've played movies every once in a while. I was like, all right, this is okay, you know? But eventually my 28 days was up and, I got moved into a sober living house, New House 2. And New House 2 was a different environment for me, okay? This was, to me, you know, softy like me, I felt like I was like in prison or something, you know? But it was just a sober living. But it was like, I was like, oh my God, these guys are hard, you know? And, you know, I was scared. I was really scared, you know? Not everyone was there for the right reasons, you know. You could live there for rent-free for like a couple of weeks until they started asking where the money was. So there were people who were just coming in off the streets, you know. But anyways, like I said, I was scared being there. And the first 2 weeks or so of living there, they put you up in a dorm with like, I don't know, 9 or 10 other guys. And I remember being in the dorm and being so afraid of just like interacting with other people. The rehab that I went to gave me a big book. And so because of it, I didn't want to talk to anybody or interact with anybody, didn't have anything else to do. I was like, oh, they gave me this book, so I might as well just like read the book. And started to read the book. And in reading the book, I found that I identified a lot with it. I guess during the meetings that I was going to during rehab, it was just kind of like, you know, I wasn't really registering it. But when I finally sat down to read the book, you know, it was making sense to me. And it was, I was identifying. And they luckily continued to bring meetings into that sober living. And in one of the meetings, someone who had been living at the house for longer than me said, hey, man, this is my sponsor, Chris, you know? You should ask him to be your sponsor. And at that time, I was so broken. You know, you could have thrown anybody in front of me who had any sort of recovery whatsoever, who had any sort of, like, semblance of having it together, and I probably would have taken their direction. And I'm glad that I kind of had that frame of mind. Because that willingness kept me sober for a long time. And, you know, if I continue to maintain that willingness, that open-mindedness, you know, that'll carry me through. So long story short, I started working with this guy, Chris. He packed me into his, like, small truck, I remember. We would just, like, kind of drive across the street into the parking lot, and we'd get into the book. And, you know, we worked the steps. You know, he got me doing my inventory. It was great. And just life in AA became really good. I got back into school, started pursuing a degree in psychology, started playing sober softball, you know, started having friends, started forming relationships. My relationship with my family was healed, you know, and healing. Life was getting really, really good, okay? So I got to read something out of the big book. I mean, it's a travesty that I haven't even yet, but just to give you an idea of like kind of what life became as a process of, or as a result of working these steps, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. And that was true for me. Like, my life, you know, I loved getting drunk. I loved getting loaded. To me, that was like the apex of just life's experience. That was like the best that life had to offer. But I found that, like, you know, in sobriety and in these steps and in the fellowship, you know, life could be this wonderful experience where beautiful things continue to happen. And it's just like exciting, you know. I mentioned sober softball. So we played Wednesday nights. After our games on Wednesday night, me and a few other guys, we had a commitment at a men's meeting down there. And at this meeting, I picked up a resentment towards another member, okay? And I won't get into the details of the resentment, but I picked up a resentment towards someone in the program. I thought that they should have, like, given up their commitment in the spirit of rotation. You know, everybody, all the commitments have rotations, right? Like 6 months, a year, whatever. But there's one person there who, their commitment just kind of, they didn't rotate, you know? And that really, like, bothered them. I don't know why, but, like, I really fixated on that, and it really got under my skin. And to my credit, I didn't ignore it, you know? I brought it up to my sponsor, and we worked through it. But after doing the inventory, it was still there. You know, I was still resentful towards this guy. And I think I might have even done, like, multiple inventories on this guy. And it still was there. I couldn't, like, let go of this resentment. And rather than, like, continuing to do the work, and continuing to bring it up to my sponsor and talk about it, I let it fester. And, you know, the book, it warns us about that. It says, it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, the business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. So obviously for me, it wasn't fatal because I'm here right now, but it 100% could have been. I let this resentment fester and fester. I didn't do the work necessary because I still had it, and got to a point where, you know, rather than doing the work on it, I started to check out library books about why AA is like BS and it doesn't work, and stopped like going to meetings altogether. And long story short, I ended up picking up again. And I was out for the majority of like 3 years. And a lot of stuff happened in that 3 years. You know, I made attempts to come back into the rooms and was able to stay sober for like chunks of time. But, you know, using and drinking was pretty consistent in those 3 months. Now, in those 3 months, I also entered a teaching credential program. This is like, you know, probably the worst that things got was like, the worst that my disease developed during my relapse was when I was in this teaching credential program. And I don't know how I even got my credential or how I didn't get kicked out of it. Because it got pretty bad. You know, I was, you know, just to give you an example, I was a student teacher at Santa Maria High School. That was my assignment, okay? And my master teacher, you know, she had like 30 years of experience. So I could have learned a lot from her, you know? But in my disease, I was like, what's she going to tell me? You know, she doesn't know anything about teaching. This is the new school, you know? And, you know, needless to say, when I got a classroom of my own, I was like fresh meat, you know? I got eaten up alive. But anyways, she would be absent here and there, you know, not excessively. And when she was, she allowed me to sub her class or sub for her. And there were days when, you know, weed is like a big part of my story. I love smoking weed. I would like roll up a blunt and smoke it during lunch of like my student teaching, you know, and come back on campus. And I thought that no one knew. I mean, like I said, somehow I didn't get in trouble. But, but yeah, it was bad. Things got worse and worse. Towards the beginning of that relapse, I met the woman who would eventually you know, become my wife. And, you know, she met me kind of like at the beginning of the relapse, when things were still fun, you know, when I was like kind of like manic and like, you know, oh yeah, you know, it was fresh, you know, it was new. And, you know, she saw things progress though, and she saw them get worse. And, you know, we got engaged eventually at a certain point, you know. She saw things get pretty dark though, and our engagement was on the rocks at a certain point. And I was living in San Luis Obispo, and I had been able to string together a few months of sobriety, okay, just basically on my own willpower. And I'm not saying that bragging at all, because me stringing together 3 months of sobriety on my own will is not a pretty picture. And I said our engagement was on the rocks, and so those two things are absolutely 100% related. So things were bad, you know, the potential marriage was not going well, my job, I was a horrible teacher, you know, and an untreated alcoholic as a teacher is not, it's not a good mix, okay? So I wanted to pick up again, you know, and I was just telling Cody this story, because weed is such a big part of my story, you know, I was like, okay, I know there's dispensaries here in San Luis Obispo, so I'm going to either pick up tomorrow. I'm going to go. The dispensaries are closed tonight. I'm going to go to a meeting tomorrow morning. And if it doesn't go well, I'm going to this dispensary in the afternoon. So I go to a meeting in San Luis Obispo. And at the time, I had a job in King City. Okay, I was living in SLO. My job was at King City High School. And that's like an hour plus drive. At this meeting, it's SLO. I shared, hey, you know, I've got this job in King City. I'm on the verge of going out again. You know, I really want to pick up. I need a sponsor. So if there's anyone here at this meeting who would be willing to sponsor me, you know, I'd really appreciate it. And at this meeting, there's another man who's a teacher at King City. I mean, that's pretty unlikely, you know. I don't believe that that's a coincidence. And he became my sponsor for the next 3 years or so. And things, again, they got really good. Life got really good. Started working the program again. Ended up getting married to my wife and, you know, sponsoring guys, commitments at meetings, regular meeting attendance. Life was growing. She got pregnant, you know. Life was getting exciting. It was getting really good again. And we knew that we wanted to move down here to Santa Maria because we had family in the area. And we just felt like we could really use the support. So we moved down here. I went to a meditation meeting at the Orchid Presbyterian Church, and Glenn led the meeting. It was a great meeting, and I remember Vinny was there, and he was really gracious in welcoming me there and gave me his number, and Raul was also there. I remember that, but I just went to that meeting, and that was it for like 9 months, and so while I don't remember consciously having the thought, oh, I'm good, you know, AA, I don't need it. I don't remember ever having that thought, but it doesn't matter whether I consciously had the thought or not. The thing that matters is that I stopped going to meetings. I stopped answering my sponsor's phone calls once I relocated. You know, I didn't get guys' numbers and stay in touch when I relocated. And so just the days passed by. The one thing, and I do want to share this, the one thing that I did continue to do, and I'm not saying this is a credit to me because it's not. I prayed every morning to stay sober, which is by no means a program, you know, that I think that this book outlines. But I did pray in the morning, and the one day that I did not pray in the morning for God to keep me sober, because I knew in the back of my mind that I wanted to get loaded. My wife was out of town, you know. Another part of the book that I wanted to read was this part on page 39. You know, I've had all this experience in AA, not all this experience, but I've had experience in AA, and I've had stretches of sobriety. So I know that I'm an alcoholic, but my problem is that, one of my problems is that just knowing that I'm an alcoholic is not enough. And sometimes I'll delude myself into thinking that I'm not an alcoholic. So sometimes I've heard people say that, like, oh, the first step is the only step that you can do perfectly. And I always kind of had it in my mind, or to a certain point, that once you've admitted powerlessness, that's good, you know? But for me, I need to admit powerlessness every single day. And so when I wake up in the morning and I say my prayers, to me, that's kind of like an admission of my powerlessness, because I am powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable without this program and without my higher power. So yeah, just this part. The actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. So day by day crept by without a meeting, without contact with a sponsor, and then my wife and 9-month-old kid were out of town, and you know, I thought, you know, I've been a pretty good dad so far. Let's go through with that whole dispensary experiment, you know? And a lot of things happened. You know, the mental obsession for me was in full gear. There was a lot of, like, potential spots for me to veer off and abort the mission. But like I lost my ID. And then I went to like 3 dispensaries, tried to get in without my ID, and they sent me away. I drove all the way from Orchid to SLO back to Orchid to get my ID, back to Grover Beach where the dispensary was, just to pick up. Yeah. So I mean, it was bad. Luckily, I don't know why things didn't get so bad though. You know, I smoked for a couple of days. My wife and our son came back, and I was gonna try to keep it a secret from them. I wasn't gonna tell them about it, and then just something in me, I don't know. I don't know exactly why I stopped and why I opened up to them, but I said, hey, you know, this is what happened while you were gone. And my wife, you know, she was not like, oh, you know, it's okay. You know, her response was, you need to go to a meeting, like, now, you know. And I think I was still not fully of the belief that I was an alcoholic. You know, I don't think that I fully admitted powerlessness. So I went to Thursday night men's meeting at Orchid. It's a Presbyterian church there. And again, I don't think I had fully admitted powerlessness, but when I got there, the vibes in the room, for lack of a better term, and just the environment and the warmth that I was greeted with, and just the sense of peace that the men there exuded, was so attractive to me that I wanted to come back. And I, you know, wanted to do what the people in those rooms were doing so that I could have what they had. And so one of the first person who approached me there was Lee. And he gave me his card. And he said something like, I don't want to, you know, misquote him, but he said something like, you know, when you're ready to get serious, take my card. Another thing that I'll remember from that meeting is Leo saying, keep coming back, kid. You know, if you keep coming back, you might stay out of the loony bin, you know? And to both of what they said, to what Lee said and to what Leo said, I was like, man, it's like, who's this guy think he is, you know? Telling me when I want to get serious. Man, it's like, you know, I just kind of like scoffed at it, you know? And to Leo, I laughed. I was like, that's a good joke, you know, the loony bin. You know, like I couldn't go back to the loony bin. But that's like both instances, that's my disease. Like telling me like, oh, you've got this, you know? Who does this guy think he is telling you this, you know? Or Leo telling me about the loony bin, you know? The fact that my response was to laugh shows that like, you know, I still thought that I had this thing, you know? And so I credit my higher power with like showing me like, you know what, I eventually got this nudge. Like, okay, you know what? Lee, rather than scoffing at what he's doing, why don't you ask him to be your sponsor? You know, he's like reaching his hand out to the newcomers at the beginning of every meeting, you know? He seems like a happy person, you know? Ask him to be your sponsor rather than that initial response. So I did like the contrary action. And I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back, but it worked. You know, doing that contrary action to what my alcoholic mind wanted me to do, which I wish I did more often, you know, it paid dividends. And I ended up working with Lee for about a year, you know, and there was a lot of really good wisdom and, you know, that I received from that. And one of them was like, one of my favorite ones was like in inventory work, you know, a lot of like, I feel like a lot of people do get hung up on that fourth step. He said, you know, he used a lot of baseball analogies. One of them was, you're just trying to get on base, okay? You can get on base a lot of ways, you know? You can even strike out, and if the catcher drops the ball, you can run to first base. And you're on base, you know? Just do it, you know? And it's another thing that Leo says. Easy does it, but do it, you know? And so, again, it's just a pattern in my life. Eventually, you know, that same nudge that I felt nudged me into asking Lee to be my sponsor at a certain point, you know, I got this nudge to ask Leo to be my sponsor. And, you know, it's not a decision that I made lightly. It's something that I talked to, you know, friends in the program about and prayed about, and it ended up being something that's worked out really well. Anyways, I'm kind of running out of gas here. But, you know, I'm really appreciative of you asking me, Zach, to lead. And, you know, if you're new...
Good, brother. Hey, everything you're saying right now...
It's not interactive.
Hey.
Quiet.
Well, it's our first time. Oh, you're good, dude. I just really appreciate it. If you're new, you know, get a sponsor. I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm not supposed to issue like commands from up here, but like, I'll say when I got a sponsor, every time that I've gotten a sponsor and have worked the steps and have attended meetings regularly, it's completely changed my life for the better. And anyways, thanks for letting me share.